is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thanks a lot for taking time out from... You're probably hanging out in the same place you've been hanging out with for a few weeks. But thank you for taking time to take a break for whatever you're doing to keep yourself entertained to come join us for another live edition of Midrats. If you are so inclined because you're with us live, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find the chat room. Right now we have Chris Raleigh sitting across the quarterdeck looking for company. So if you'd like to go and join Chris there in the chat room, if you have some observations you'd like to make during the course of the show and our conversation here, or if there's a specific topic or question you would like for us to address in the course of the next hour, that is a great place to do it. And as always, if you got to run off and take care of some business, try to learn how to cut your own hair or whatever's keeping you busy today, you can always go over and subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, whatever you use to listen to your podcast, and you can catch up on what you missed. So, being that the intro's done, Eagle One, my illustrious co-host, how are things up north?
Well, here in the lovely Piedmont area of North Carolina, things are pretty good. Except you just, you know, I've seen neighbors now. I didn't know I had. Everybody's out walking these days.
We've seen that too. A few folks have, because in my neighborhood I live in, where houses were all built after the front porch era had departed. So nobody has a front porch. So instead what people are doing is dragging out, their deck chairs onto the front driveway. And like every fourth or fifth house this afternoon, people just been sitting out there drinking in public. But you know, I walk my dogs all the time. So I, like you, I've seen some neighbors I hadn't seen for a while.
Yeah. And it's maybe this will be a good thing. Maybe people will actually get to know the people around them.
Yeah. I think, yeah, you got to find the positive in it. It's kind of like, I think we've talked about this before in different venues, but you know, Hollywood loves to have the national Freudian slip, natural disaster movies where everybody is running around like a chicken with their head cut off and strangling each other and fighting and stealing. But that's really not how we react to situations. People usually pull together. And I think that at least that's more or less our national character that we share with other nations as well. I think that's manifesting itself. We'll see what happens in 6 months or so. But besides the people who can never leave election year politics behind, everybody else is being pretty reasonable. It's going out in town. I know a lot of our local institutions have actually implemented a couple weeks ago for those that are 65 and older, special hours for them. And everybody seems to be dealing with all the stresses we have pretty well at this stage of the game. I think we'll see people under a lot more stress here over the course of the next year as the economic reality of this turn really starts to impact more people.
Yeah, I think it's also been interesting. I've seen a lot of families starting, I call them victory gardens for want of a better term, but I mean, I cannot believe the number of folks who now have started some kind of vegetable garden in their yard. And, you know, that may be an anticipation that things may get a little rough on the food supply chain down the road, but we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, it's. I think we've seen it not just here, but in Europe. I saw something where my friends in Belgium, they've got 750,000 pounds of potatoes that are just rotting that they're think their prime minister asked for people to double their rate of frites consumption, i.e. French fries, which would be an easy sell for me because those are the best French fries from in the low countries there. But I think a lot of it also has to do with the fact that there's large portions of our diet, and French fries is part of that, that people would eat when they would go to restaurants, and not as many people are eating in restaurants. And the logistics system is working just fine, but the input is problematic. And it's not just food. You know, you've seen that with, I believe you have, and a lot of our listeners definitely have seen the charts of all the oil tankers outside of Los Angeles, off of China, off of Dubai, all trying to find places to store all this stuff, because I'm not a petroleum engineer, but from what I understand, once you shut a well off, it's not like turning on the spigot. Some wells, if they stop moving there, they don't come back. So, the input to the supply chain is going to be interesting to watch over the course of the next few months. How much are you paying for unleaded up where you are?
Well, I don't know, because right now I'm getting about 2 weeks to the gallon, so I haven't had to fill up for a while.
Why? I have a truck with 185,000 miles on it, so I was doing a seafoam treatment. For you motorheads, you know what that means. And so I was on empty. I put in 16 gallons worth and then put my seafoam in it. And I paid, when I got my 5 cent discount, I paid $1.51 for gas. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I usually buy it at Costco, so I'm sure it's down below $1.40. Last time I filled up, it was below that. So anyway, speaking of things that make a difference, though, I saw an article in Foreign Affairs that had the interesting title of Do Pandemics Promote Peace? Why Sickness Slows the March to War, which I thought was kind of an interesting concept, because there's also an article that I saw on Real Clear Defense talking about the PLA's exploitation of the coronavirus pandemic. So I'm a little confused between these two articles, whether we're headed for an era of peace brought by sickness, or whether we are now looking at further exploitation of the of the commons, shall I say, by the PLA and the Chinese government.
Probably depends upon who you're referring to, because you know, the 1819 flu, Spanish flu, had that impact, went well into 20, and you had the Russian Civil War that was going on, including the Western intervention. You had the Turks getting rid of the Greeks from Smyrna, which everybody calls Izmir now. All the majority Greek cities on the Aegean coast, they were being cleared out by the Turks, as they were telling the French and the British they didn't care much for their post-World War I view of Anatolia. But I think for a lot of countries and I think civil wars are different, and you can go back into medieval history, which are slightly different people than us. Most modern nations, when they become more internally focused, vice externally focused, they're less likely to want to go on adventures. But it would be, if that was a good byproduct, I think that's wonderful. I think, though, in the medium term, what COVID-19 is going to do is it's going to severely impact Western militaries' ability to execute military operations, simply because how do you recruit, train, and prepare for war when you have, for instance, you know, we'll get into the TR in a minute, but the USS Kidd, which was another part of that operation, FFG 100. She's a type. I'm sure Brian McGrath will yell at me for this, but I'm pretty sure that's a type 2A. So they have a complement of between, 300 and 330, depending upon what percentage of their nanny document and their air debt, et cetera, and so forth. And I read where the kid earlier last week or earlier this week, depending upon how you define Sunday, reported 18 sailors with COVID-19. And as of yesterday, when I read the report, 33 of their sailors have been medically evacuated from the ship. So that's 10% of ship's company in a pretty short length of time. And as we know from 2017, you can't take too many crew members off of an Arleigh Burke, and you quickly become ineffective in a variety of areas. So we've seen the Charles de Gaulle as well. I think we're going to have some type of regular monitoring of all of our underway ships. At least, I don't know, not my area of expertise, but we should plan for at least a year.
Yeah, I think that's right. The other side of this is the article in the Foreign Affairs points out that the slowdown in the world economies is what is probably the driving force behind a lot of these peace things, because all these economies are being damaged. China, according to the International Monetary Fund, says China will have slower growth this year than any time since 1970s. The question, I always have lurking in my mind is, if you've got if you're China and you think you've got some kind of leverage because everybody else is hard down, you've got 80 billion people to throw at problems, do you decide that while we're still responding to COVID-19, that it's time to do, I think we talked about this last time, is it time to do something or how, and that would sort of ease the Chinese public perception of what's going on. I mean, it depends on, I guess, how desperate if they are at all, the Chinese Communist Party is about what would happen if the people get really unhappy, and whether if they think a recapturing or attempt to recapture Taiwan would be a worthwhile effort. They're out there rattling sabers. Both the South China Sea and in the Straits of Taiwan. So kind of an interesting time, something to keep an eye on.
I agree. I think you hit on the key there, which is their internal stability. So the Chinese are all focused on, which I think is why, and we talked about this last week a little bit, their tone and their inflection and their choice of words has been quite bellicose the last few weeks, I think, because they're trying to get the Chinese people to push their anger and frustration out, vice looking in, which I think would actually play to us if we wanted to not give them that straw man and encourage the people to look internally, because the China concerned with their internal development is less likely to make trouble outside. But that's hard to read. That's really hard to read. And a lot of people trying to track what COVID is doing where, you've got to ignore the numbers and reporting out of China. There are other places. India is going to be interesting to watch, but you really can't look at their numbers either, because India is still quite the developing country. Yes, it's a democracy, but they just don't have the healthcare infrastructure to be able to do. I mean, people get sick and die on the streets left, right, and sideways even to this day, even though there are certain cities that have really started to progress well. But India has a way to go. And my concern is, you're talking about the economic impact. We haven't fully appreciated what's happening here yet, much less the rest of the world. But you have places like sub-Saharan Africa that even on a good day, they are going to have trouble giving their population enough standard of living to stay where they are. You take what little float they have left and combined with a lot of the countries like Nigeria, that the overwhelming amount of their national income comes from oil, you're gonna have problems. People need to eat. People need to have confidence in the future. And if they can't get it locally, they're going to go someplace else. And that goes into Europe's migration challenges. That is what you need to watch is the second and third order effects from this, especially, and I think everybody needs a plan on this. There's a lot of people hoping for a vaccine, but I think we need a plan for there not being a vaccine. And that's a tough thing to war game.
Oh, absolutely. I see that Sal Mercoliano, I'll never get it right. Anyway, he's in the chat room. Okay. Sorry, Sal M. And he had a pretty interesting piece that he tweeted out earlier about those tankers you were talking about sitting off L.A. And other parts of the world. And one of the questions I have related to that, not necessarily about the tankers, and your question, your issue with the shut in a well. Most wells can be shut in. I mean, there are a few that they're always got the pump jacks on because they don't have much in the way of force of the oil itself. But most wells can be shut in. But it's a long process to get everything geared back up to deal with the glut that we've got. And there's no place to store refined product. There's no place to store the crude. And this is going to be talking about long-term ramifications because of the importance of oil to our economies. But I'm also looking at and this is one of our topics we've hit on, who has the most ships that's bringing all these containers to us that contain all these goods that we and necessary supplies that we seem to farm down around the world, and more specifically, so a lot of the stuff goes to China. You know, if China decided that this was a good time to throw some leverage around, how much can they do in way of slowing deliveries or stopping deliveries of stuff to our shores that we would need that we don't currently make because we farmed it out to someone else?
Oh, they can absolutely.
How much of an act of war? How much of an act of war is that?
Yeah, I think that's. Oh, that's good. And a lot of this has to do with their internal calculus. How many factories are they willing to shut? How many unemployed people do they want to add in order to try to make a point with the U.S.? This is going to be a staring game, and hopefully, while we're staring them with our hands, we're resourcing where we get our items and produce our items, whether that's bringing it home with increased automation or go places like, and goodness knows these people need the economic benefit. If you're looking for low labor cost, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, Panama, ignore the damn communists in Nicaragua, let them stew, Colombia, there are people in our hemisphere that definitely could use the employment. Again, not my area of expertise, but I think most Americans would be willing to pay an extra 5 or 6% for an item if it's not sourced in China. But we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, just one more thing to kind of worry about. Speaking of things to worry about, let's talk a little bit about North Korea. Kim Jong-un seems to be a little under the weather, or maybe even under the dirt.
I saw a great graph earlier today that reminded me of a history professor trying to explain the relationship between the Plantagenets and the Tudors and how that works. About the Kim, not only can you it's the whole weird connection of going from a communist revolution against Japanese colonial rule becomes a hereditary dictatorship. That pretty much it come down to, and his older sister, relatively old, I think she's in her mid 30s, maybe early 30s. Everybody remembers her from the Olympics, You know, is she going to step in? Is the military old guard going to let her? There are, I know he has some brothers and half-brothers out there, but they're non-players in the game. That goes back to one thing that I think was clear when Un moved in, is the not just the political elite, but really the military elite in North Korea. They have the most to lose if they can't keep the system going. Because in that horrible, cursed country, their military elite has all the benefits. You know, the old cliche, always feed your army. I think they're becoming the power brokers as opposed to the kids known as the Kims. In the 21st century, you know, how do you do that type of dynastic interactions? It could be an opportunity, depending upon how the cards come out of the deck. I'm sure the South Koreans have few courses of actions and plans that they could do to help facilitate one way or another. But I don't think it, even best case scenario, is going to end pretty or clean. But who knows? Maybe that hereditary dictatorship could go another century. Who knows?
Yeah, he has a, when he was alive, he had a if he, or healthy, or whatever he is right now, he had a distinctive way of dealing with people who might be a threat to his premiership. What's the right word for those clowns? You know, he had his uncle taken out in the airport in Kuala Lumpur by agents rubbing VX chemicals on the guy's face. I mean, he, you know, he's been known to take like rocket launchers and shoot them at people he didn't like. It's kind of a difficult guy, and I don't, you know, this, I don't know what the rest of the family is like, but I know there was one younger brother. I think a younger brother who might have been a cousin. I can't remember who was had attended college in the West and was kind of, you know, I'm apologizing for the North Koreans' behavior toward its own people, but he's kind of vanished. So kind of an interesting, almost, you know, it is almost like reading Game of Thrones or something here. It's the same kind of dynamics.
And I guess the Chinese is going to play the role of the Iron Bank, where, you know, they, last thing the Chinese need right now is instability on the Korean border. They'll find, hopefully, some way to keep that under control. The South Koreans, they have no interest in absorbing North Korea anymore, I don't think. But if the opportunity presents itself, they might. But nobody really wants to go over to war over. Because anybody, what would take to take those people in that culture, in that country, and not just bring it into the 21st century, but just, heck, bring it into the last, you know, bring it into 1980, God, what a monumental effort. It'd make what the Germans did with the former East Germany look like a holiday. But maybe this type of turnover keeps them focused internally, so they're less likely to be a pain in the tail externally. But I always got to feel a little careful throwing shade too much at the North Korean dynastic politics, because, hey, I was, when I was doing a little bit of show prep today, I was reminding myself what a horrible month April has been for the Navy specifically. And, you know, let's back up to what we talked a little bit about last week. Is this timeline, it would be funny if it wasn't so sad. Is it was on the 31st of March, less than a month ago, that the CO of the Teddy Roosevelt, Captain Crozier, released, unquote, his letter. He was removed on the 2nd of April. On the 7th of April, the acting SecNav, yeah, the frag pattern caught him. He resigned. And I think the numbers as they last came out, when this all started, they had 4,938 sailors on the TR. So there's your denominator. They started out with 114 people positive. That's 2%. And Now we have 856 infected at 17%. And they've got 4,234 of the sailors off the ship. 86% of people are off the ship. And I think it's still a valid argument. Good people can disagree, but maybe what Crozier did was the right thing, and maybe firing him was the right thing. Two things can be true at the same time. But when I was going over this with my very smart significant other, and she made the point that if Crozier didn't move when he did, that 141 that's now 856 or 17%, what would that numerator be? Would it be double that? Triple that? I would like to see the numbers off the Charles de Gaulle, what those percentages are. And, of course, we'll see how the kid develops from here. But I think the great professionals at the Medical Service Corps of the U.S. Navy, they're building some good models of this that can let us know. But if this is the new normal, everybody's been talking about herd immunity recently. How long are we going to go through this routine where you get X number of ships underway, Y percentage of X has an outbreak and becomes combat ineffective for Z length of time? We kind of touched on that earlier, but I thought those numbers off the TR were impressive, where even though Crozier moved as fast as he did, we're still looking at the end of the month, 17% or 856 of the crew members have come down sick. Only one death, which, again, it's a good figure.
Yeah, I think you have to look at some of those cruise ship numbers. And, what I recall was that a fairly high percentage of the people on the early cruise ship, I can't remember, it was like 80% or so, never got it. Were not infected or anything else initially. Now, and I think that was kind of like, well, if we can isolate people, maybe then a lot of the people who were infected on the cruise ship were the crew, because their quarters are completely different than the individual staterooms that a lot of the passengers have. So, the berthing spaces on a carrier or on a destroyer are not individual staterooms like on some Canadian other foreign ships, where everybody has their own little space. So I can imagine that the numbers on the Truman and on other Navy ships would be pretty much higher than those numbers on a cruise ship.
But, yeah, you and I both know, because especially on a carrier, there are a few ladder wells that, good Lord, if you have 5,000 people on board a ship, every day you've got 500 hands touching the same part of the stairwell. It doesn't take long. And I got a note from a friend of the show, made a very good observation. Everybody remembers the great dramatic farewell to Captain Crozier when he left the ship. There was no social distancing going on there at all. And you got to cut him a little bit of slack, because, again, the world has gone very far in the course of the last 30 days. Social distancing was not quite the law of the land at that point, but yeah, you got to wonder until you get people off a ship, how do you isolate crew in 75 man berthing? It's not going to happen.
Well, I think that was Crozier's point, but, this all gets lost in somewhat political stuff. And to get back to the should he be put back in charge? Should he be given another ship? Should blah, blah, blah. And I think you hit it. We've discussed this before, both an impossible situation for the people involved. And now we've got an outsider, really outside of the Navy food chain, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, sticking his, expressing his interest in the matter and seeking, well, last I heard, he was seeking further review or an investigation to see what should be done. This just gets more murky. I mean, sometimes you just have to make a decision and kind of live with it. And I thought that's what had been done when when Mobley fired Crozier and then Mobley resigned, and we were back on track. And again, politics raised their head. Crozier is now in limbo, which I don't think he's got COVID-19 too. Last time I heard, so what a mess.
It's exactly a mess. And I wrote weeks ago over at USNI blog in support of Captain Crozier, and I've been fairly consistent on it, and I stand by every word I wrote. But I think it would be a huge mistake to put him back in command of the TR. The ship is combat ineffective right now. The air wing, good gracious. The ship needs to move on. The Navy needs to move on. He needs to move on. And putting him back in there, all that does is it's an after-school special. Nobody needs that. The Navy will take care of its own. He has plenty of great opportunities to serve from there. And the thing about the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, it's not a conspiracy if you believe it, I guess. But a good fiction writer could write up, especially with how petty things are, that this is an opportunity to take an already weak Navy and make it even more weak. By the way, you can't blame it. Inter-service rivalry. It is what it is. It starts at the service academies and it doesn't end from there. And it's not just us. It's universal. It's always been true. But you can't blame them for hitting you over the head with a mallet that you built and gave to them. And I think that Miley, either the best of intentions or the most parochial intentions, I don't think it matters, but I think we're set up for a third defenestration. There we go. One of my favorite words. I should be able to pronounce it. The third defenestration of the flags that we've had in this decade, almost half a decade, really. The first, and all has to do with Westpac, Fat Leonard. Then we had the events of the summer of 2017. And now we're coming up with this TR. And I think a very good argument could be made that the flag officers and the administrative and the operational chain of command between Crozier and the acting Secretary of the Navy, all of them can be relieved for cause. They're great guys, great individuals. A couple of them I'm actually a fan of. But and I'm including the CNO in this, the silence from the flags here has been, what message does this send to leaders, uniformed leaders in our Navy, whether they're a midshipman about to be made a second lieutenant or an ensign, or that bull lieutenant deciding whether he wants to stay on for the 04 board to go forward, or the 05 or 06 deciding if they want to punch out immediately or go forward. This, I'm going to hold my breath and wait for the IG to tell me what was the right thing. As the appearance is given, I haven't seen anything else. Letting our civilian leadership either twist in the wind or do jobs they're not supposed to do, it's been unwieldy for me to be able to try to get my head around what I've been watching here. Maybe I'm all wet on it, but if we have a third defenestration of the flags in Westpac, we got nobody to blame but ourselves.
Yeah, I saw, and again, this is, when it gets up to Secretary of Defense level, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs has got himself in it, apparently the rumor mill is that CNO and the acting Secretary of the Navy, are kind of in favor of putting Crozier back on the ship. And that then it gets stuck at the next level up. So, apparently CNO at least has been supportive of Crozier at this point. But, I don't know the politics of it. I'm never was a Pentagon warrior, but I just, you know, you're, I think you're right. I think that SecDef and you know, there's an army. The army mafia doesn't mind bothering the Navy that much, I guess. But you know, somebody just needs to. I don't care which way it goes. I do see some danger in putting him back on the ship. I do see some. If he's as good a guy and admiral potential, that's totally up to the boards that meet after this. But just do something and let's get this behind us, because this is just a time drag and a black eye on the Navy for all the reasons we've already set out on a couple of shows now. But it also points out, I think the other. Oh, go ahead, sorry.
No, I interrupted. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to change the subject. So you had thoughts on Crozier. You go ahead and finish it up.
I'm pretty much done. I just want the Navy to go forward. There is too much going on here for us to continue picking our belly button about the same topic that we've wasted most of April on. I would much rather have the new acting Secretary of the Navy and the CNO expending every bit of professional capital and waking hours they have finding the best way for us to operate for an extended length of time as we wait for some type of herd immunity I don't think it's coming anytime soon, or some type of vaccine to come along that can allow us to, when a ship gets underway on January 1st, and if she's going to do a 6-month deployment, that she's going to be able to go forward and show the flag for 6 months and not go away for 7 weeks, have a third of the crew come down with COVID and have to come home on a regular basis. That's what I want them focused on, not looking back to, you know, how do we best end this after school special. It's just unseemly. But if the Secretary of Defense needs to wait for the Ouija board to stop moving around to make his decision, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff wants to have our well-known, effective, efficient, accurate, and quickly timed IG process to tell him what his answer is, that's their job. Good luck.
Yeah, and one more ramification, which the other Sal has raised in our chat room, one more ramification on all this is, you know, Air Force Academy had its graduation. They had all their cadets 6 feet apart sitting down in chairs on a football field, I guess it was parade ground. And the Naval Academy announced it's not going to have a public graduation ceremony. But the Military Academy has... announced, I guess because the president wants to speak to them, that they're going to recall all the cadets and have them go through a 2-week isolation period, and then graduate them, I guess, at a regular graduation ceremony. You know, those are three options. what is there a good one, or are we punishing the West Point folks because they're silly enough to have chosen the Army?
Well, you know, you screwed up. You chose Army, so you know, pick your rate, pick your fate, whatever. For full disclosure here, I'm in a variety of ways. I'm rather weird. I don't like ceremonies, even though.
No.
I was master of ceremonies at change of commands and all that crap, and I stood behind the podium and tried not to have my sword hit people, all that junk. I don't like them. I don't like all these overt displays of militarism. I don't like them. So I think what the Air Force Academy did was actually hilarious. I don't know if you see pictures of it. The Naval Academy, well, you know, whatever, guys. go take your ship selection and go forth and do great things. If the Army wants to do the Army thing with their 14-day isolation afterwards, it'll be an interesting experiment. I don't think they're going to have them sitting cheek to jowl. I have no idea how they're going to do it. Maybe they should have just done a big Zoom call, had everybody have their stuff overnighted. I don't know. It's a weird time, but we have three experiments. We have the Army, the Air Force, the Naval. I don't know what the Coast Guard's doing, but we could all check back in 6 months and see whether anybody got more infected or not. The good news is you got a bunch of men and women in their early 20s, almost, and none of them have any underlying medical conditions, because they did, they wouldn't be graduating from the academies. Odds of any of them getting very seriously hurt with COVID are small. So if you're looking for a silver lining, it's not like they were, you know, having a whatever anniversary of the Battle of the Philippine Sea reunion and everybody was cheek to jowl. So it is what it is. I think it's kind of silly though.
Yeah, I don't have any. I mean, I mostly skipped my graduations from everything that I could. So it's not been a big thing for me. And the way I got commissioned all by myself in a room with the CO of the ROTC unit. So,
congratulations on this significant career milestone.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we finally got your order, so we're going to send you to California, and good luck in your future career. So I don't know. Maybe it's a big deal because, you know, here these poor guys, people have, you know, men and women have gone through the process of the academy, and, you know, watched 3 years of people graduate before them. And, you know, you kind of hate to see them miss out on that if that's important to them. On the other hand, in the great scheme of things, the ceremony usually makes no difference to anybody's lives. And if I can find anybody who remembers anything that a graduation speaker ever said at a graduation other than blah, 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 then I will give that person, $5. But, you know, I don't remember going to any graduation, or certainly don't remember any speeches. So I'm not sure I was sober either.
Yeah, there's a shocker. It was the 70s. It was a different time. It was okay. No, I think that's kind of universal. Hey, I don't know whether we should turn this into let's throw shade at the Army episode, but why the heck not? I want to get your thoughts on this, because of all the possible responses to the Iranians, which I think everybody's overplaying this in a variety of ways. Let's, you know, one war at a time here. If we could not unnecessarily light up some Iranians for being jackasses, that would be great. But there was an article that came out in Bloomberg on the 25th about a way to bolster the U.S. Navy presence with the Chesty Puller and the other forces that they're running around circles in their upgunned fishing boats, is to use AC-130 gunships and Apache attack helicopters. I think we have our own version of attack helicopters with our Seahawks. And if memory serves me right, I don't think you want to have Army helicopters doing extended duty on board naval ships, because they're not designed for long-term exposure to salt water. And why you would use an AC-130 gunship, that big, fat, slow thing, against the Iranians, who have a lot more capability to shoot back than the Taliban or the Islamic State, I don't know. But I don't know who did that troops to task filling of the CJ SOAR. They decided AC-130 gunships and Apache helicopters was the way to help defend Navy ships. But hey, if you need joint credit, that's one idea.
Yeah. The H-60 Sierras have some pretty good capabilities. And I think the Marines, maybe they decommissioned, but I just I haven't paid attention to it, but I thought the Marines had the old sea cobras, which
they do.
You know, did they decommission them? Are they still around?
Yeah, what they did is they upgraded their UH-1s to the, I think it's UH-1 Yankee, and then the upgraded Cobras are Zulu mods. But yeah, they're fully upgraded, and even their Hueys, they gun those things up pretty well. You don't need Apaches float around rusting in the middle of the Arabian / Persian Gulf. But somebody thinks we did.
Yeah. Well, they're wrong, because we've already got the stuff, and it is navalized equipment. And I have at various times proposed using those AC-130, whatever the designation is now for the Spookies. But it was, you know, that was if you my proposal always was if you were confronted with the Iranian flying boat, what do they call those things, wing and ground squadrons that they had, you might as well just put the AC-130s up there and let them have a field day with that stuff, because why not? And, you know, they're land-based. They can stay up for quite a while. But that's an Air Force mission. That's not an Army mission. And so, as far as I know, all those aircraft belong to the Army Special Squadron, whatever that thing is. So, I don't know. I think there's a place for the AC-130s, not for the Army Helos. And I remember my last experience landing Army Helos on Navy ship. Everybody was confused, including the LSO, who happened to be me at the time, because they don't have wheels, they have skids. In those days, they had skids. So, anyway, that was quite a while ago. But
it's all very confusing.
Go ahead.
No, you're
going to step all over each other today. No, I was going to say that one of the solutions to the too many crewmen on a ship kind of thing is to have more smaller ships with smaller crews. And that way, if one ship gets sick and you have a lot of these little smaller ships, then you don't have, you're losing, say, 1% of your force instead of 5%, whatever the number would be if you lose a early Burke class destroyer now.
Exactly. I mean, that's another variation of one of my hobby horses. And we've talked about that with a few of our guests. It's always bothered me is I think that the green eye shade cult of efficiency has made too many decisions where, yes, it's more efficient to have larger ships with more stuff on it, and that works great on a spreadsheet, but not at war, because then you lose one ship and all of a sudden you can't do your mission. You assume way too much combat risk in doing that, as opposed to having slightly less efficient but more effective smaller ships. So if you go into an operation with X number of ships, you know that you can continue the mission with Y minus Z. You can have some combat loss and still get the job done. And you know, COVID plays as well as that does too. So yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, I think somebody needs to go back and let's dust off the Sobrowski's Street Fighter concept. I know we keep talking about frigates and there's a place for that, but we really need to look at I go back to the old Pegasus PGMs and stuff like that. You know, yeah, they're not open ocean transit blue water ships necessarily, but boy, around the island chains of Asia, what a great tool having something like that would be. And they're cheaper to make. So, other Sal, your chat room comment on the national debt and cuts in military, you know, you can build a lot more smaller ships, smaller and much smaller ships, for the same dollars you get for spending on, say, one F-35.
Yeah, and numbers also put a nice little message. You know, one of the things that was nice to see, it's straight out of central casting. You know, you're talking about that part of Asia, is the presence mission. We had the large deck amphib, or as if you want to start a fight with somebody, you call it a Jeep carrier. USS America, along with the Bunker Hill and the Barry. So you got a CG, a DDG, and our USS America large deck amphib. With that little bit of uncomfortable standoff between Malaysia and China, the Australians even came out to play with us a bit too, which was really neat to see. It's a shame we couldn't get the Malaysian Navy to come do a photo op with us. But, neither one of those ships have played COVID, but who knows how long that's been. And the sad thing is, and you know this as an old Westpac sailor, there's some great Liberty ports in Westpac that I don't think any of these ships are going to be doing anytime soon. So that's part of that presence mission and showing the flag is coming in, paint an orphanage or two, exchange some geedunk with your counterparts at your host nation. But with COVID, I don't think we're going to be doing that anytime soon. So we'll have to do the little more toothy version, which is when somebody misbehaves, we get a handful of U.S. Navy warships and maybe a friend or two just to cruise around the waters and wave.
Yeah, that'd be ideal. We also need to look at, back in the day we had Subic Bay, we had some pretty good facilities in Japan, and you could use smaller ships, could have operated from there. In fact, that's how the Asiatic fleet kind of worked for a while, didn't operate out of ports in the Philippines. But what are we going to do now? We got Singapore. And we've got Japan still, but you can use Guam, but it's a long haul from Guam to the San Bernardino Strait. That's the argument against the ships that are too small and don't have the legs to go that distance, which raises the issue of why don't we have some kind of, if you're going to make smaller ships, where's our tender that could kind of either carry these guys out there and then sit in some location that where our friends would be that could, take care of these small boys while they're out doing what they should be doing, zipping around island chains.
Yeah, it was rather apparent that there were no LCS that went out to join the American formation. I don't know what they're doing in Singapore. Maybe they're getting depot level maintenance. But we've talked a bit here, and we're going to make the other Sal very happy to say this, but it goes back to the unsexy but important. When you look at all the depot level maintenance that you need to do, especially if you surge in Westpac, and if you don't have those facilities ashore, or even if you do, they're nice static targets. Now that our opponents have gone from near pier to pier, it doesn't take much to take out a static facility. Whereas if you have a nice tender, not just a submarine tender, but a destroyer tender out there as well, you can do a lot of that depot level maintenance that our optimally manned ships can't do. And we talk about what happens when you do try to do that. What happened to the McCain is a prime example. I don't see anybody who wants to do that. Just as I haven't heard anybody say why that's a bad idea. It just doesn't have any of the support. It doesn't have any of the advocates, and therefore it doesn't have a funding line. So we're just going to have to find some way to operate out there. And the only way to do that is to build ships that can reach out at those ranges and do more, which I was hoping that we would hear more about FFGX selection. But who knows when that's going to show up. But how many we're going to wind up buying there over the course of the 2020s, I don't know. But, boy, how much professional capital does Navy leadership have left in the Pentagon and up at the Hill to try to make things happen? When we're done with this Crozier event, especially if the chairman of the Joint Chiefs does what he wants to do, we're lucky to be able to get whatever scraps wind up on the floor.
Yeah, I think we're in for a tough financial time. I think that we have spent money foolishly, and without And I like the idea of the Zumwalt class monstrosity. I mean, the concept made sense as originally conceived, but did no one know that these shells that this thing could fire were going to cost $8 billion each? I mean, and why aren't those people being reduced in rank, even if they've already retired, that made these goofball decisions and got them funded somehow through Congress so that you couldn't possibly, you know, these programs that should never have gotten off the drawing board, but when they got off the drawing board, somebody should have stepped on their neck and killed them much quicker than they have.
I mean, all this stuff was known. It's same thing with LCS. It's brief, the best case scenario. Otherwise, we're not going to get what we want. And anybody that objected to that got hammered. So the best case scenario kept getting made better and better and better. And I remember a conversation I mentioned on the show before that I had with Admiral Fogo half a decade ago or so. I was like, you know, we need to have, instead of having just a handful of officers every now and then going get their PhD in economics, and the only option you get for them is to go teach microeconomics to midshipmen. It's like, no, we need to have those people in the Pentagon on major staff because you need somebody who thinks like economics to help you make informed decisions. Anybody with a background in economics could have told you with what they were trying to do with DDG 1000 was a setup for failure. Especially when they said, well, we're not going to build 36, we're going to build, I think it went to 18 at one point, then 3, then your per unit cost, et cetera, and so forth. And it was such a bespoke system, such an exquisite system, that there was so little flex there. So I think the announcement went out that they've now delivered Zumwalt to the fleet, and it's like, okay, we have a Graf Spee-sized thing that we're calling a destroyer that's the whole reason for existence doesn't work. Nice missile sponge, I guess. But there you go. But in that's a shame because that requirement for naval surface fire support hasn't gone away anywhere. It's just it doesn't have what was promised to it. It really is a shame, but it's a good lesson, as we talked about before, for those young men and women right now that are going to be running the programs in the 2020s that's going to produce the fleet of the 2030s and the 2040s, if they have learned the right lessons from especially LCS and DDG 1000 and to a lesser extent some of the early mistakes with the design of LPD-17, and those lessons are manifested in good decisions and solid leadership, that maybe the younger generation will make better decisions than the previous one.
Well, I'm just fascinated by the fact that the Marine Corps is adapting to being sea duty type, you know, no longer want to be maybe they never did want to be the junior army, but you know, they're getting back to their sea heritage. And the question that keeps running through my mind, that includes abandoning some of their, you know, demands on this, we got to have this massive amphib fleet because God knows when we're going to attack Iwo Jima again. And you know, what's that hold for the future? I mean, does that mean the Navy can then say, well, look, the money we were spending on these amphibs, which is a considerable amount, you know, yeah, we need the baby flap tops like the America, but you know, some of these other ships, I can't remember if the America has. I don't even think it has a well deck. Does that class have well decks? How do they get their Marine shore except by vertical envelopment, and you know, and there's no gunfire support ships either. So what are we doing here?
Yeah, neither one of those. That's a two ship class. They don't have a well deck, but the follow on ones they put them back in. So yeah, it's all Osprey and 53 delivered and whatever else you throw on there. But you know, it's an experiment. Experiments are good. It would just be nice if we had more classes to experiment with, but we have what we have.
Yeah. You go to war with the Navy, you have.
Yeah, as the great Dom Rumsfeld once said. Well, I mean, as we start to wind up the month of April, I'm glad to see it behind us. What's the top subject or two that you're looking forward to for the month of May?
Well, I would like, first, from the Navy perspective, I guess we're going to get an indication of the FFGX selection. I hope we do not go down the road of the LCS and decide we're going to build, you know, two different versions and let them fight it out down the road, which they, by the way, have never done. And so that's something to look forward to. The other thing is, I would like to see, I think one of the big things could be bringing a lot of this industry back home. And I know we've talked about this before. There used to be an agency in the federal government that kept track of vital defense industry things that we needed to keep in this country and keep the businesses going. I would think things like, you know, pharmaceuticals would have been in that category. And I'm kind of surprised that it wasn't. But I sure would like to see a lot of this stuff come back. I'd like to see – I don't see if the economy is – in trouble, and we're going to lose a lot of businesses. I think the department stores, you know, the Macy's and the, I don't want to name too many names, but you know, those classic stores, those are history. You know, what are we going to do with all these people? And my question is, well, you know, if we're going to build a bunch of ships and things, I know we can create some jobs, and especially in areas that could really use them, you know, the Gulf Coast ports, Mississippi, and you know, we used to have all these great Navy shipyards in Brooklyn and in San Francisco. I guess we still have something going on in Mare Island, but I'm not even sure who's running that nowadays. But you know, we could help, sort of like World War II helped the economy. I don't want to think we need World War III to do that, but we could sure use some money to develop the infrastructure in the country and build up some of the defense assets we need.
Yeah, there's actually an opportunity here, because when we got rid of a lot of these industries, they've been cold iron and the buildings have been torn down. So if you have to rebuild them from scratch, you're not going to have, you know, 10,000 people walking through the shipyard gate every morning again. But if you're going to bring these businesses back, you're going to make them modern, kind of like what happened with German and Japanese industry after the Second World War, because we bombed their legacy systems into oblivion, and then the Russians toted what was left back. When they rebuilt their industry, they rebuilt modern, up-to-date. We have that opportunity here, more automated, cleaner, more effective systems. So there's some opportunities here. Hopefully we have, you know, smart people looking at it. But again, you got that headwind of the economy and what the national priorities are going to be because of it, which is kind of a great lead-in for our listeners. Next week, we're going to have a guest, and our guest is going to be Todd Harrison. He's from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's the director of their defense budget analysis and their aerospace security project. He's a senior fellow over there on their international security program. He's going to be our guest for the full hour. One thing we're going to talk about is what the military needs to look at and define as its crown jewels going through the next budgetary crisis. So kind of rack and stack what you absolutely have to have, what you need to protect, what you don't, what the trade-offs are. So for those that are interested in that budget battle, you know, make sure and join us next Sunday, because I think it's a very timely guest we're having.
Very much so. And that being said, we need to wrap this show up. It's been fun.
It has been. And our friend the other Sal, and also Chris Cervello, and Chris Raleigh, and the folks in the chat room, y'all been pretty active today. We like that, because y'all bring up some good ideas. We can steal it and claim it as ours. So I do appreciate everybody joining us here for another edition of Midrats. Hope everybody keeps their hands all washed. And do join us again next week. You do not have to bring your calculator or your green eye shade, though there might be math.
All right. Well, you have a good week.
Hey, you too. Thanks, everybody. And until next week, hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly.